From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Los Angeles.
John Paul's 27-year papacy has been one of the most significant and far-reaching in the history of the Church.
Today, we look at the legacy of Pope John Paul II. As Laura Bush makes a surprise visit to Afghanistan, we look at the state of the country 3.5 years after the U.S. invasion, and we go to Zimbabwe to talk about the national elections. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Los Angeles. As of this broadcast, Pope John Paul II is in what the Vatican describes as very grave condition and has been administered the last rites after suffering heart failure on Thursday. The 84-year-old Pope reportedly decided himself not to go to the hospital. According to the Vatican, he is still conscious, lucid, and tranquil. The Vatican says the pontiff asked aides to read him the biblical passage describing the final stage of the way of the cross, the path that Jesus took to his crucifixion. This latest health crisis, only a day after doctors fitted him with a feeding tube, was set off Thursday by a urinary tract infection. That infection, the Vatican said on Thursday, caused a high fever in the already frail and weakened Pope, who has suffered for more than a decade from Parkinson's disease. The last time he's known to have been administered last rites was on May 13, 1981, after he was shot by a would-be assassin in St. Peter's Square, almost 3 years after he was chosen pope. We'll have more on the pope later in the program. Voters in Zimbabwe have gone to the polls in parliamentary elections in a vote being watched closely by the international community. The elections passed off peacefully, but the opposition and human rights groups said it wasn't free and fair. President Robert Mugabe dismissed these claims as nonsense. During the campaigning, Mugabe characterized his opponents as being stooges for British Prime Minister Tony Blair and claimed that Zimbabwe's economic crisis is the result of intervention by Washington and former colonial power Britain. We'll get reaction from Harare in just a few minutes. Terry Schiavo died yesterday, 13 days after her feeding tube was removed, in a case that sparked national debate on the right to die and sparked one of the greatest conflicts in history among the three branches of government. Terry Schiavo's husband and parents feuded to the bitter end and continue to. When she died, she was reportedly cradled by her husband, Michael Schiavo. His lawyer, George Fellows, said she died, quote, a calm, peaceful, and gentle death at about 9 a.m. No one from her side of the family was with her at the moment of her death. Her parents, Bob and Mary Schindler, were not at the hospice. Her brother had been barred from the room at Michael Schiavo's request moments before the end came. Schiavo's death brought to a close what was easily the longest, most bitter, and most heavily litigated right-to-die dispute in U.S. history. The World Bank Board has unanimously approved the nomination of Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to be the next president of the 184-nation institution. The board that approved him consists of 24 members. Earlier this month, President Bush surprised the international community by recommending Wolfowitz for the job. Wolfowitz is known as a hardline foreign policy hawk, a leading neoconservative, one of the main architects of the invasion of Iraq. The bank traditionally had a U.S. president and its sister institution, the International Monetary Fund, is headed by a European. Protesters gathered outside the World Bank headquarters in Washington, D.C., in opposition to Wolfowitz's approval. He takes over June 1st. A U.S. military plane with 9 people on board has crashed in central Albania. There are believed to be no survivors. According to news reports, the aircraft was taking part in joint exercises with the Albanian military. The American Civil Liberties Union yesterday sent a letter to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez asking him to open an investigation into possible perjury by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the theater commander at the outset of the Iraq invasion. The ACLU said the memo sent by General Sanchez flatly contradicts sworn testimony given by him before the Senate Armed Services Committee, in which he denied authorizing highly coercive interrogation methods. The ACLU called for the appointment of an independent special counsel by the Attorney General. The ACLU obtained a physical copy of the memo under an ongoing Freedom of Information Act lawsuit and released a hard copy on Tuesday. The memo is dated September 14, 2003, was signed by Lieutenant General Sanchez. It laid out specific interrogation techniques modeled on those used against detainees at Guantanamo Bay for use by coalition forces in Iraq. These include sleep management, the inducement of fear at two levels of severity, loud music and sensory agitation, and the use of canine units to, quote, exploit the Arab fear of dogs. During sworn testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, General Sanchez flatly denied approving any such techniques in Iraq and said that a news article reporting otherwise was false. The Presidential Commission investigating the justification for the invasion of Iraq has said U.S. intelligence on Iraq was, quote, dead wrong in almost all of its pre-war judgments about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. At a time when Washington is accusing Iran of nuclear ambitions and pressuring North Korea on its nuclear programs, the report says, quote, across the board, the intelligence community knows disturbingly little about the nuclear programs of many of the world's most dangerous actors. A key chapter in the report on U.S. intelligence on alleged nuclear weapons programs in Iran and North Korea was classified and not released publicly. But sources familiar with that section said it was among the most critical, finding U.S. intelligence on Iran's nuclear program in particular to be inadequate. The report is very critical of former CIA Director George Tenet, but avoids any criticism of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Here's Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution.
The bottom line here is anybody who had access to the raw information, which Tenet did, which President Bush did, Vice President Cheney, et cetera, anybody knew that there was a debate about just how far Iraq might have gotten with its nuclear weapons program, for example, and should have known that there was uncertainty about how trustworthy the Iraqi defectors were who were providing us information on chemical and biological weapons.
Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. President Clinton's former national security advisor, Sandy Berger, has agreed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor charge of giving up his security clearance for 3 years for removing classified material from a government archive. Berger's also agreed to pay a $10,000 fine as part of an agreement reached recently with the Justice Department after months of quiet negotiations. Berger was a senior policy advisor to Senator John Kerry during the 2004 presidential campaign, but he quit the campaign abruptly in July after accusations surfaced he'd inappropriately removed classified material from a secure reading room at the National Archives. When the issue surfaced last year, Berger insisted he'd removed the classified material inadvertently, but as part of a plea agreement, he's expected to admit he intentionally removed copies of five classified documents, destroyed three, and misled staff members at the National Archive when confronted about it. Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero announced on Wednesday his country will sell more than $1.3 billion worth of military equipment to Venezuela, risking harsh criticism from the U.S. Zapatero made the decision during a visit to Venezuela earlier this week, where he joined a summit of Latin American leaders, including the presidents of Colombia and Brazil, Alvaro Uribe and Ignacio Lula da Silva. Ted Koppel, who's anchored ABC News Nightline since its inception a quarter of a century ago, said Thursday he will leave ABC when his contract expires at the end of the year. But Koppel says he's not retiring from the news business. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has strongly condemned the invasion of Iraq and the global anti-terror drive, accusing the U.S.-led coalition of using food deprivation as a military tactic and of sapping efforts to fight hunger in the world. Jean Ziegler also highlighted what he called widespread concerns about the continued lack of access to clean drinking water and allegations that the U.S. blocked off water supplies from Fallujah during the siege earlier this year, which Ziegler said was a violation of the Geneva Convention. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Los Angeles, California, where we're in the midst of our Unembed the Media tour, having celebrated Pacifica Station KPFK last night. Today we head to San Francisco to celebrate KPFA Pacifica Radio. And on Sunday, we'll be in Seattle celebrating KBCS in Seattle. And on Saturday, also in Portland, Oregon, as well as Seattle. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, Thursday, parliamentary elections took place in Zimbabwe. Reports from the country say the elections went off relatively peacefully. And for the first time, the opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, was able to campaign openly. The party's the first seriously challenged President Mugabe's government since Zimbabwe won independence in 1980. But even before the election, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, Morgan Tsvangirai, charged the election was rigged. He said, quote, "We're not happy with the way the electoral playing field has been organized. This is not going to be a free and fair election," he said. He repeated the charge earlier today after the polls closed.
"I am very confident that it will reveal the extent of the fraud constituency by constituents. And by the way, we'll be able to tell you, I've already made the preliminary announcement, as you have said, which was, how do you have 10% of the votes sent, of the voters turned away? Some of the examples."
That was Morgan Tsvangirai, leader of the Movement for Democratic Change. Opposition leaders and human rights groups claim the voter rolls were inaccurate and that many who tried to vote were turned away. They also point to widespread fear and intimidation before the voting began. President Mugabe dismissed these complaints, calling the elections completely free, and the Movement for Democratic Change a pawn of British Prime Minister Tony Blair and other Western governments. Mugabe stated he was, quote, entirely, completely, totally optimistic of victory for his Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party. He called the election the anti-Blair election. Mugabe also dismissed the accusations of vote fraud at a pre-election rally on Wednesday. Mugabe told supporters, quote, "They know they will lose. They've prepared themselves to say the elections were not free and fair because of this and because of that." Well, today we're joined on the telephone by two people who have been following the election results. We're joined by Omawale Clay. Omawale Clay traveled to Zimbabwe to monitor the elections. We are also joined on the telephone here in the United States by Margaret Lee, a visiting scholar as the African Studies Program of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Omawale Clay is an activist with the December 12th movement here in the United States. Omawale, let's begin with you. Can you talk about what you observed?
How you doing, Amy?
It's good to have you with us.
To the Pacifica audience from Harare, Zimbabwe. I have been here with a December 12th International Secretariat Foreign Observer team, which was invited by the government of Zimbabwe to participate in observation of this historic election. I've been here on the ground for 2 weeks. We have traveled through three major provinces, and on election day, we viewed over 15 constituencies in terms of different polling stations. And I have something very important to report to the Pacifica community in general and to African people in particular, that yesterday the people of Zimbabwe resoundingly said they will never be a colony again. Unofficial results have confirmed that ZANU-PF has won a major victory, and by all counts will in fact capture over two-thirds of the electorate, which will give them the ability to restructure their constitution, to institutionalize the Third Chimurenga, which was always the view of them fighting for the total emancipation of their people politically and economically. So I wanted to make sure to bring that to people, to also let them know, Amy, that democracy in Zimbabwe is not anything new. For the past 25 years, as we celebrate the 25th Silver Jubilee, democracy was brought to Zimbabwe through national liberation armed struggle, and it was never given to the Zimbabwean people. But since 1980, when the first elections took place, there have been six major parliamentary elections that have taken place, and there have been three presidential elections that have taken place. So no one can teach Zimbabwe democracy. Zimbabwe is teaching it to the African and Pan-African world, as well as to the neo-colonizers who are trying to recolonize Zimbabwe. To give you a little background, Zimbabwe has over 5,700,000 registered voters. For this election, there were polling stations numbering 8,256. There were 50,000 translucent voting boxes, Amy, so that everyone could see the ballots that were in the boxes. There are over 7,000 international observers on the ground here and over 203 international press crews. SADC, the Southern African Development Community, has election observers on the ground, and it's important to note that Zimbabwe is the first country and the only country to hold its elections along the guidelines and principles of the SADC election laws. And so the question of elections in Zimbabwe is really more tied to the question of whether Bush and Blair, Britain and the United States, are able to capitalize on their plan to recolonize Africans. We all know that the land question in Zimbabwe is why Zimbabwe is in the news. There have been elections and corruption going on all around the third world, but why is all the attention on Zimbabwe? Why is Tony Blair interested in the elections in Zimbabwe? Since the A1 and A2 land reform programs have been instituted, 14,955,967 acres of land have been returned to over 138,235 households in Zimbabwe. And this is historic. Never in the history of the African world has there been a mass transfer of land, wealth, the real wealth of the people, been transferred back to the households. And so this is what the real issue is, Amy, in Zimbabwe.
Omawale Clay is speaking to us from Harare, Zimbabwe, having observed the elections yesterday in that African country. On the line with us from the Washington area is Margaret Lee of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a visiting scholar in the African Studies Program. Your assessment of the situation in Zimbabwe?
First of all, thank you, Amy, for inviting me to participate in this very important discussion. I was recently in Zimbabwe. I have to admit that I was not able to observe the elections. I was recently in Zimbabwe at the end of, end of January. And I have followed the Zimbabwe situation for two decades now. And while I think that we do have some semblance of democracy in Zimbabwe, I think that one has to give perhaps a more objective overview of the situation. I mean, we know that since independence in 1980 that the ZANU-PF has made it very clear that it has no intentions of giving up power to any form of opposition. So if you look at the history of Zimbabwe, the opposition movements that have come into existence have always been marginalized by ZANU-PF. Now, one of the problems right now, I think, in the country with respect to the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, is that just like many other opposition movements, it has compromised itself. So one of the things that was very clear when I was in Zimbabwe in January was that there was not the same level of fear about the MDC that existed at the end of 1999 going into the elections of 2000. And when I say compromise itself, specifically it aligned itself with the white farmers, many of the white farmers who had a vested interest in making sure that the land was not returned to the indigenous African population. It aligned itself with many individuals in South Africa that were not deemed to be pro-post-apartheid South Africa. It even aligned itself with RENAMO in Mozambique, and that was the liberation, so-called liberation movement that was involved in incredible atrocities against the indigenous population in Mozambique. So there exists a lot of problems within the MDC. So I cannot honestly say to you that the election was compromised at this point. What I do know is that no matter what the outcome of the election, it's very clear that ZANU-PF has no intentions of giving up power. Mugabe has pretty much made that very clear. And also, I would like to suggest,
he was elected to office. So when you make that statement, could you please be factual about it? There have been 3 presidential elections, and there have been 6 parliamentary elections over 25 years. You could not make that same case for probably over half of the countries in the world. So when you make the statement, they have no intention, that means you're getting ready to make a subjective analysis as if you're in Mr. Mugabe's brain. Why don't we deal with the program of ZANU-PF? And I understand that you haven't been to Zimbabwe that much.
Oh, Mawali, first of all, please understand I've actually lived in Zimbabwe, okay, so that I've had extensive experience in Zimbabwe, and I was just there at the end of January. Now, what we do know about the history of elections in Zimbabwe is that most of the elections are very free and peaceful in the sense of the actual election day. But you cannot ignore all the human rights reports. You cannot ignore on the ground
human rights reports that come from international organizations that are tied to Western imperialism?
Well, I'm not going to get into
human
that.
Human rights watch,
what
human
I know
Amnesty
is that I have read human rights reports coming out of Zimbabwe. I have talked to individuals as recently as the end of January who very much felt that they were living in a military state. I actually experienced sitting in Zimbabwe and security guards coming closer and closer to the two of us who were in conversation with two young men from a high-density area. So what I'm trying to suggest
are you saying to me that you believe that ZANU-PF is not the party that the people of Zimbabwe has chosen to lead them?
What I'm trying to suggest...
I mean, I would just like you to be very clear about this.
What I'm trying to suggest...
Where you're coming from is...
Let's let Margaret Lee respond to that question.
I've given you the courtesy to speak.
Margaret,
okay. Okay, so please respect me in that light, okay? And we can have a very fruitful conversation. What I'm suggesting to you is that I take a historical analysis of the Zimbabwe situation, okay? And what I'm saying to you is that since 1980, ZANU-PF has made it very impossible for the opposition movements to gain ground in Zimbabwe. That's a historical fact. There has been, most recently, since 1999, incredible intimidation against those who support the MDC. The reason that I started by raising questions about the legitimacy of the MDC is to lay the foundation for the possibility that at this time, many individuals, given the fact that the MDC has compromised itself so much, do not necessarily see the MDC as an alternative to ZANU-PF. And therefore, what I'm trying to suggest is that out of fear of the unknown, namely that they do often fear that the MDC does represent the Western imperialist powers, that because they don't see a government that may be run from the West, that yes, they do see ZANU-PF as the only alternative. It does not necessarily mean that they do not want change. They don't necessarily see that the MDC is the route to go. And therefore...
You see what I'm saying, Margaret? Here's my total disagreement with you.
That's fine.
The basis of what you're saying sounds totally subjective. I don't hear it based off of any facts. Let's microscope the election we're talking about right now. Because I don't want to go through a historical thing with you, because what you're saying doesn't have substance to it.
So what
you're
kind
talking
of facts
about
do you
going
want?
Into
I mean,
people's.
Ask, what
let
kind
me
of
can
facts?
I just finish? Can I finish?
Okay.
You're going into people's heads, and you're telling me what the people of Zimbabwe, what they really want to do. The people of Zimbabwe fought a national liberation war. It wasn't a few individuals, it was the masses of Zimbabweans armed and supporting their right to self-determination. It is 25 years since that time. It is a new democracy, but it is a very clear one on the question of which direction they want to go on. The people of Zimbabwe can choose for themselves who their leadership is, and they have resoundingly chosen that. The NDC has been a product of British imperialism. It has been financed by the farmers. It has been financed by the West. In fact, I quote to you, Margaret, Chester Crocker, the Assistant Secretary of State of African Affairs, when they were passing the Zimbabwe Democracy Act, one of the points he made to the senators in testimony, and you can go to the testimony, so it's not something that's in my head. You can go to the testimony. He said, to separate the Zimbabwean people from ZANU-PF, we're going to have to make their economy scream. And I hope you senators have the stomach for what we have to do. That is a clear statement that the real problem that they have in Zimbabwe is the marriage between the Zimbabwean people and their national liberation forces. ZANU-PF is
Clay.
The people of Zimbabwe.
Omawale Clay, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but we will certainly continue to look at Zimbabwe on this day after the national elections. Omawale Clay of the December 12th Movement speaking from Harare, Zimbabwe, and in Washington, D.C., Margaret Lee of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies with the African Studies Program, recently back from Zimbabwe. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at Afghanistan. Laura Bush made a trip there earlier this week. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about Afghanistan, First Lady Laura Bush made a surprise visit to Afghanistan this week. Laura Bush was surrounded by heavy security, spent a total of 6 hours on the ground. She met with women training to be teachers at Kabul University, U.S. troops at Bagram Air Base, and President Hamid Karzai. Laura Bush is a former teacher and librarian. She thanked the troops for ousting the Taliban. She said, quote, thanks to you, millions of little girls are going to school in this country, little girls who were denied an education just 3 years ago. Laura Bush also announced plans for the U.S. to build an American University of Afghanistan and an International School of Afghanistan for children to receive a Western-style education. Though President Bush often cites the country as a symbol of success and on the road to democracy, he's never been to Afghanistan. We're joined here in Los Angeles in the studio by the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. She is the host of Pacifica Station KPFK's morning show Uprising. Sonali Khatkar joins us. Sonali recently returned from a trip to Afghanistan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Great to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the surprise trip of the First Lady, Laura Bush?
You know, Laura Bush used Afghan women to help launch her husband's war right after the 9/11 attacks in late 2001. And this was a time when the Bush administration's operation in Afghanistan needed a little bit of a boost. Karen Hughes is back on the team. She was the initiator of that, of the whole marketability of Afghan women, if you will, to promote the Bush administration's liberation, so-called liberation of Afghan women. So she went back, completely surprise visit, and she took with her $21 million for a school in Afghanistan, highlighting all of these superficial positive changes. Of course, what we didn't hear was that at the same time, the U.S. spent about $83 million upgrading its military bases in Afghanistan. And really, that's the U.S.'s main goal. They want to be in Afghanistan for the long haul. It's a very convenient, very strategic military area for them where they can have their bases. And they're spending much more, of course, on military operations than they do on humanitarian projects.
And what about where women stand now? I mean, it's often raised. They can go to school. Her point, many point of the Bush administration, girls are being liberated and women in Iraq,
right.
In
we hear,
Afghanistan.
We hear the thing about, you know, that fact about 5 million girls are now going to school. It's wonderful. When I was in Afghanistan, I noticed that in Kabul, certainly schools were open. Women were walking around fairly openly with not as much fear. Outside of Kabul, where 80% of Afghans reside, totally different situation. There are no schools. I visited the Farah province, which is a very isolated, remote province in western Afghanistan, and there were no schools except for the one school that Afghan Women's Mission is funding that's administered by our allies, the members of RAWA. Aside from that one school for girls, there are no schools in the region. And so we hear all of these very superficial things about how great Afghan women are, you know, the progress they're making. The UN just released a report recently on Afghanistan where they described Afghanistan's education system as, quote, the worst in the world. And, you know, we never hear that. Our media, when they cover Laura Bush's trip, will not mention, will not do their homework and will not mention these facts.
What about warlords?
Warlords is the most important problem in Afghanistan today. Everybody I met talked about how they were really happy the Taliban was gone, and then they said, well, now we've got these warlords who are ideologically the same as the Taliban, they're just less organized. And the U.S. has backed these warlords, some of them, since the 70s in the fight against the Soviets. And they empowered them at a time when the Afghan people just did not want them around. Instead of undermining them, Hamid Karzai has actually put them into positions of power. Ismail Khan is now the Minister of Energy, and he is an extremely fundamentalist warlord. Abdul Rashid Dostum, the war criminal whose forces were implicated in the massacre of Taliban soldiers. You remember that documentary, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death? Well, his forces were the men implicated in that massacre of thousands of Taliban. He is now the Army Chief of Staff. And Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, called Karzai's moves wise. So the Afghan people are extremely dismayed because they voted for Karzai on the platform that he would not compromise with warlords. Their hopes are being dashed. And the warlords, I think it's important for us to understand, give the United States an extremely good excuse to stay in Afghanistan. The Afghan people are tolerating foreign troops because they see them as an antidote to the warlords. So the U.S. continues to allow warlords to flourish, empowers them, pushes the Karzai government to keep them in power because it means that the U.S. can stay there for the long haul.
Sonali Khatkar is the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. We are also joined in our New York studio by filmmaker Carmela Baranowska. In June 2004, Carmela was embedded with 800 U.S. Marines in one of the most remote and dangerous parts of Afghanistan. She made a film called Taliban Country, which is a disturbing exposé of American actions in Afghanistan. Here's a few excerpts of the film.
In the next village, Lieutenant Colonel Khan believes he's found an important lead in his search for the Taliban.
This used to be an old Taliban leader's compound. Mm-hmm. And the guy that we captured just a few moments ago is a known Taliban leader in this area. They've been looking for him for the last 3 years.
Sure.
So that was a good find. Look at this.
Where did you find him?
He's sleeping in a field.
This was with that
with a loaded weapon.
It was with the wrong.
All right.
Hey, Rice, let's get out of here.
Well, I'm thinking maybe the next road back.
As the sweeps wind down for the day, Lieutenant Colonel Hahn makes a joke about the surrounding opium poppy fields with a militia leader who calls himself the Minister for Agriculture.
Tommy's doing a very lousy job. I don't see any agriculture.
We're there so much for you that we might show up with a come zarat, come see my neddy leader.
Say it.
Уртала, ком позратки гаплят кариди по дяденьки бят окраем.
If I didn't take any action of my agriculture, but I'm
too busy fighting.
Yeah, I'm busy.
I'll tell him, inshallah, once we get rid of the Taliban and Al Qaeda here, and improve the security of this nation, then he can have more agriculture and water.
That was a clip from Taliban Country by filmmaker Carmela Baranowska. Here is another clip from the film.
It's a few weeks later, and I decide to head back independently to the same area of central Afghanistan without the presence of the Marines and the militia. I want to find out the real story behind the American and militia operations. I travel Afghan style with a driver, translator, and two armed policemen. Their brief is to safeguard us from roadside robbers, but we all realize that there is no real protection against the Taliban. After 6 hours, we're back in the village of Mossazai. At the forward operating base, the Marines processed and tagged the 35 villagers. This man, Wali Muhammad, was arrested by the US Marines Force Recon Unit, their forward operating intelligence unit. He spent 3 nights in detention.
When they took us away from here, this is what happened to us. They made us stand like this. They fingered us, beat us, humiliated us. There was no food. My legs gave way. We were asking desperately for food. There was nothing. They gave us water, but spilled it over our mouths, noses, and eyes. They shoveled snuff up our nostrils and into our eyes. They told us not to look at them. This type of cruelty has never been done to us or seen by us. We've never seen this type of cruelty.
An excerpt of the film Taliban Country. It's by Carmela Baranowska. She is an Australian filmmaker and joins us in the Firehouse studio in New York. Carmela, can you talk about this extraordinary experience you had embedded with the troops looking at Afghanistan?
Well, for 3 weeks, I was embedded with U.S. Marines in one of the most remote and dangerous parts of central Afghanistan. And while it was very interesting, and I was really the only person there last year who spent that period of time embedded with them, I felt this kind of certain uneasiness. I felt that there were more questions I wanted answered. I felt that they were only wanting to show me certain things. So I decided to go back independently. And the film is really interesting because it's the only independent eyewitness account in these US military areas from the whole of last year. And I would also warrant from this year, there is no independent eyewitness testimony coming out from journalists in Afghanistan. And that's a real problem.
What do you think, Carmela, is the most important issue that has to be highlighted and understood about Afghanistan?
Well, from the perspective of the film, you know, I I do believe that there must be transparency. There must be military, you know, investigations that are revealed to the public, because don't forget that the U.S. military's own detention practices, its own investigation into what went on, into what is going on in Afghanistan, was supposed to have been released in June. Now, I was in that area a couple of weeks later, and it seemed to me that because there is no transparency, there is no release of documents, there is no accountability, that the human rights abuses continue and there is impunity.
Sonali Kohatkar, what about U.S. forces in Afghanistan, NATO forces in Afghanistan?
Well, NATO had been in Afghanistan for the past year under the International Security Assistance Forces framework. Basically, they've been providing security in Kabul, only 5,000 troops. And since the Taliban fell, there have been foreign troops in Kabul, which is why Kabul is safer than the rest of the country. And these folks are basically providing a sort of antidote to the warlords. And Afghan people, including Karzai, had been begging for international forces, preferably under the UN, to be expanded throughout Afghanistan. And the U.S. had been resisting that because it would somehow interfere with their operation in the provinces. Basically, the U.S. wanted to be able to act in the provinces alone with no oversight and with impunity if it felt like it. Now, however, NATO forces are slowly expanding into other provinces, but they're operating in what are called provincial reconstruction teams, where basically they do aid work and they provide supposedly security for building wells and schools. And the aid community is really upset about this because it undermines their impartiality. That's why Doctors Without Borders left Afghanistan last year after a number of their workers were killed. Doctors Without Borders had been in Afghanistan for over 24 years when the worst of the worst atrocities were happening. Now it's become too dangerous for them to work in the provinces.
And the role of Zalmay Khalilzad?
Khalilzad is he's the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, and he is basically the guy who's running the show in Afghanistan. He's the one who makes the decisions. He's the one who's done the backroom dealing, ensuring that warlords are in power. He has been saying that
He's Afghan himself.
He's Afghan-born, but he's a U.S. citizen. And he says, look, we need justice, that's fine, but we first must have peace before we can have justice. And Karzai just parrots that. And he's a man, when I talk to Afghans, I ask them, well, what do you think Khalilzad's doing? Do you think he's acting in the interest of the Afghan people? And uniformly, the Afghan people were like, no, we know that this man is acting in the interest of the United States, and we understand this. We just wish that he would stop influencing our government so much. So he's really running the show.
He's a former UNOCAL consultant.
This is a man who was formerly a consultant for UNOCAL, and I'm not sure necessarily whether that plays a big role right now. Certainly there is, you know, there was the whole incident with the UNOCAL company wanting to do a pipeline, oil and gas pipeline through Afghanistan and trying to make a deal with the Taliban when Clinton was in power. That's not necessarily on the table right now, and even if it were, it's not as major a project as the military bases, but Khalilzad is one of the original founders of the Project for a New American Century. He's a neocon at heart, and he is part and parcel of the Bush administration core group.
May he be the next U.S. ambassador to Iraq?
He has been tipped off, but it's not clear whether it's going to happen for sure. But I think one thing we should learn as anti-war activists is take a look at what he's done in Afghanistan, and that's what's going to be in store for Iraq.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sonali Kohatkar. Your website?
Yeah, our website is AfghanWomen'sMission.org, and I encourage people to go to our website. They can write to the media on our website and urge them to cover Afghanistan, cover it accurately, and cover it more often.
And Carmela Baranaska, I want to thank you for being with us in New York. Where Taliban Country can be seen here, your website?
The website is talibancountry.com. You can view the film online. And just very quickly, what I'd also really like to, you know, try to push for, and I know the ACLU is really trying to release the military documents dealing with Taliban Country and looking at the three military investigations that have resulted because of the film, and also the battalion commander, a very interesting Pakistani-American called Lieutenant Colonel Asad Khan, was fired, and he's now left the Marine Corps as a result of the film. So I'd really urge your listeners and viewers to visit the website, talibancountry.com, and to, you know, discuss with colleagues and friends the situation in Afghanistan. Thanks.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Carmela Baranowska and also Sonali Kahatkar.
Thanks, Amy.
When we come back, we'll talk about the legacy of Pope John Paul II. Stay with us.
Prescription blues. I got the blues. I got the Cipro prescription blues. It ain't the letter I want. It ain't the one I
Prescription Blues by a local Los Angeles artist, Chicago Red, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, as we continue our Unembed the Media tour. We are traveling around the country tonight. We'll be in San Francisco and head on to Portland, Oregon, and then Seattle this weekend, Philadelphia on Monday. Pope John Paul II is in what the Vatican describes as very grave condition and has been administered the last rites after suffering heart failure Thursday. The 84-year-old Pope reportedly decided himself not to go to the hospital. According to the Vatican, he's still conscious, lucid, and tranquil. The Vatican says the pontiff asked aides to read him the biblical passage describing the final stage of the way of the cross, the path that Jesus took to his crucifixion. This latest health crisis, only a day after doctors fitted him with a feeding tube, was set off Thursday by a urinary tract infection. The infection, the Vatican said on Thursday, caused a high fever in the already frail and weakened Pope, who suffered more than a decade from Parkinson's disease. The last time he's known to have been administered last rites was May 13, 1981, after he was shot by a would-be assassin in St. Peter's Square, almost 3 years after he was chosen Pope. We're joined now on the telephone by Tom Cornell, an editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper, founder of the Catholic Peace Fellowship, one of the first people to burn his draft card in protest of the Vietnam War, co-editor of the book A Penny a Copy, Readings from the Catholic Worker. We're also joined by Robert Ellsberg, the editor-in-chief of Orbis Books. In the mid-70s, he was the managing editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper, author of the book All Saints, Daily Reflections on Saints, Prophets, and Witnesses for Our Times. He also happens to be the son of Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers fame. Robert Ellsberg, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the legacy of Pope John Paul II?
I think that the way people perceive the Pope, you know, depends sort of on their perspective, where they're starting from. And the image of the Pope in the U.S. Tends to be shaped pretty much by how you stand in relation to a certain, you know, hierarchy of moral issues, role of women, homosexuality, abortion. And, of course, you know, on those grounds he is lauded by conservatives and, you know, many liberals and progressives would tend to see him as a very conservative or reactionary force. But I think that, you know, that's looking at it through sort of an American lens or the way that his image is filtered by the American media. And probably his legacy in the rest of the world will be shaped much more by an awareness of his strong commitment to social justice and the rights of the poor, labor, human rights, his critique of liberal capitalism and those kinds of issues.
Tom Cornell, can you talk about those issues?
Sure, I'd like to. Everyone knows that Pope had some kind of link with the fall of the Soviet Union and the downfall of communism. They're not aware that there's a link between the Berlin Wall and the nonviolent revolution against Marcos in the Philippines in the late 70s. Cardinal Sin was supported by the Pope in that instance, and that gave the possibility of mass nonviolent direct action to other people, including the Germans. On the labor front, Karol Wojtyla was teaching a variant of the labor theory of value back in Krakow in the 40s, when you could be exiled from the University of Chicago, of St. Louis, for teaching the same thing as one of my friends did. Commonweal published a version of the Pope's teaching on that subject some years ago. Over and over again, he reiterated the principle established in 1893 of the universal destination of goods. That means that everything in creation, all goods, are meant for all people. And although we defend the principle of the right of private property must always be viewed under the rubric of the common good. You want me to go on? I can go on. Labor
well,
should never be...
What I'd like to go back to Robert Ellsberg about is the brief thumbnail biography of the Pope, where he was born and his role through the 20th century.
Well, this is, you know, a Pope who has experienced firsthand some of the kind of crushing ideologies of the 20th century. He experienced Nazi occupation of his country. He experienced communist rule of his country, and that was gave him a kind of shaped his view of the world, and certainly a sense, I think, also of his of the role of the church as a force that stands against totalitarianism. And the affirmation of the human person against in the face of great forces, dictatorship, war, oppression of various kinds, and that was certainly one of the factors that kind of shaped his own personal sense of destiny and his sense of the role of the church in the world. In some ways, it overdetermined his view of the world. I think it made him overly suspicious of liberation theology in Latin America, for instance, because of its use of certain kind of Marxist categories of analysis. He tended to see that, I think, in some ways as a dangerous flirtation with the communism that he had experienced, and made him very suspicious and reserved toward that. Though ultimately, he embraced a lot of the rhetoric and the language of liberation theology, and spoke of structures of sin in the world economic system. He adopted the language of the option for the poor, and he certainly put the his own personal authority behind movements for nonviolent social change.
And where the church goes from here, who replaces the Pope when he dies? Tom Cornell.
I'm not available.
You're married, for one thing. Rules you out.
No, I don't know. I mean, Pope can do what they want. Joking here. I think they're going to go for an older man. Certainly it will be a moderate conservative, because the College of Cardinals has been seated very nicely with people who can be counted upon to keep the ship as steady as possible. moderate conservative and of some years. Someone like Tete Manzi, someone with a social progressive view, but a moderately conservative theological view.
I think the point there is that this is a pope who's had an extraordinarily long reign, and that is, you know, has, you know, its positive and negative aspects, and I think the church is not going to be eager once again to choose somebody who's going to have such a long and you know, dominant kind of effect in determining you know, the future of the church.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Robert Ellsberg of Orbis Books and Tom Cornell of the Catholic Worker and the Catholic Worker newspaper. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now! As we continue our Unembed the Media tour. We head from Los Angeles to San Francisco today. Tonight at 7, we'll be at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater on Lyon Street, celebrating KPFA Pacifica Radio. And tomorrow to Portland, Oregon at 1 o'clock, we'll be at Baghdad Theater. In the evening on Saturday, we'll be at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, looking forward to talking about who owns the media with Bob McChesney and Phil Donahue. And on Sunday morning at a fundraiser for KBCS Community Radio. Monday night, we'll be in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania Law School, and then we head to Sarasota, Florida on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we'll be in Huntington at Book Review as we launch the paperback edition of The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. You can go to our website to see the whole Unembed the Media tour. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team. Mike Burke, a very happy 30th birthday. Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.